Hail, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the few minutes. We have with us on the line our good friend John Leffler, and I just thought I'd comment on a cartoon my wife had pointed me to. I'd been away for a few days, and it was in the local newspaper, and it showed a husband and wife, and they're each looking at newspapers, and the wife looks over at her husband and says, "You know, those pictures of the flag-draped coffins don't look so bad now." The inference being, of course, that comparing those with the pictures we've seen of the torture of the Iraqi prisoners, why the coffins really weren't such a terrible thing. But I think what we're doing, if you look beyond what's going on, behind what's going on, nobody's really being punished. Oh, a few reprimands. Yes, you shouldn't be doing this, but this was obviously done intentionally, the release of this information done intentionally, and I believe that we are inflaming the Muslim world against America in preparation for the coming world war. John, it's good to have you with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Good to be here.
All right. Do you have any thoughts before we get into our regular discussion this evening on, of course, what's happening, the major issue that we see before everybody, the terrible embarrassment of the mistreatment of the prisoners? But I don't know why anybody should be surprised. We treated the prisoners at Guantanamo exactly the same way. We treated the Muslims who were arrested after September 11th the same way. A recent article in the New York Times tell about the rape of this one man with a flashlight, and of course he's suing the government for this. The total cruelty with the way these people were treated after September 11th, and I'm talking not about Guantanamo, I'm talking right here in the United States, but you're just not hearing about that sort of thing. We're doing everything we can to turn the Muslim world against America and against Christianity because they look upon America as a Christian nation.
Yeah, even more interesting part of the battle has been the willingness of the current administration to pitch constitutional protections to the wind. I think that is more discouraging. And I know we have two cases up before the Supreme Court right now, and the one that I'm concerned about is the Padilla case, because it's one thing to take somebody prisoner on a battlefield, and it's another to arrest somebody at an airport or here and then accuse him of being something which he then has no opportunity whatsoever to prove that he is not. And that was, I think, Dr. Alan Keyes was one of the first people on national TV to actually come up with this recognition. So if they arrest me for whatever the reason and they accuse me of being an enemy combatant, then suddenly I lose all of my constitutional rights. I disappear into a prison where I may just rot for years and habeas corpus be darned. And the danger, of course, is since this is a unilateral declaration that is made on the part of, you know, whatever administration is in there, that's pretty dangerous because, as Dr. Key said, you're arrested and you never have an opportunity to prove that you are not what they are accusing you of.
That's right, and I think that this is what we're seeing is the destruction of the very foundation of our law, and what a terrible tragedy is that a Christian Republican administration would be doing things, that we would have been horrified if Bill Clinton had done. But it seems that if you're a Christian Republican, it's perfectly all right to do it because we know you would never do anything wrong.
Well, we also have people like Jay Sekulow, and I've heard him defend this, and I keep thinking, Jay, what is going through your head? Because Alan Keyes is very quick to figure out what this really means. And the whole bit about, oh, you know, trust us, we're from the government, or we'd never use this against regular citizens, or this or that. Horsebucky, you wouldn't. Once the precedent has ever been established anywhere in law, whether it's with forfeiture or any of these issues, rapidly these things came to be applied against regular citizens. And because of the fact that all you have to do is be declared an enemy combatant, boy, this is dangerous. This is really dangerous stuff.
Right.
The other issue they're finding, I was reading some, what some of the attorneys were saying in a number of these trials that had gone forward with these people who were accused, is when they were getting civil trials, the government, the prosecution, was always watching to see whether or not they felt they were losing the case and the defense was winning. And if the defense was winning, they would threaten them with declaring the defendant an enemy combatant, which means the civil trial would just be suspended and the person would disappear into prison, guilty or not guilty. It didn't make any difference. I think people need to really wake up to what is going on out here.
Well, I think another thing that they do is they arrest people and they put them in prison indefinitely with no right of habeas corpus because they will be a material witness in a trial, and they're afraid that they might disappear. So we just got to hold them indefinitely in prison without right of habeas corpus because they're going to be a witness against somebody else. What they're doing is running roughshod over the Constitution, running roughshod over the law, all in the name of fighting terrorism, which we are not doing. We've never tried to get Osama bin Laden. We could have gotten him easily many times, and even when we went into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden after 9/11, we wouldn't allow our troops to go in after him. The Green Berets were forbidden, and we have that's covered in a book called Crude Politics by Paul Sperry, who writes for WorldNet Daily. So it's all a facade, you know, to get the American people to be willing to give up their freedom in the name of the war on terrorism.
Yeah, and Americans are just, for some reason, very naive. They never dream it will backlash upon them. Some of the most startled people of the last 20 years were liberals when they suddenly discover their property could be forfeited just on the mere accusation that some kind of a forfeiture-related crime had been committed. And they'll go, well, this is America, you can't do that. And, of course, law enforcement goes, ha, 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 as your property disappears, and they don't care because this is now a big method of off-budget accounting. So the law of, or the rule of what we have seen happen here in the last 20 years has been once you allow the abuse, it just goes down this slippery slope rapidly, and there's no reason not to believe that this will not go either.
Well, anybody,
second thing, if you've known, go ahead, Stan.
Well, I was just going to say that they have repeatedly said, and I've attended meetings with leading conservatives who have said, the Patriot Law has never been used against anybody except terrorists, and that is a total lie. We've got at least five different articles from various instances when the terrorist laws have been used against gamblers, you know, or criminals in Las Vegas. They use these terrorist laws not against terrorists, but against anybody they want to, because once they have the power, it will be misused. Power corrupts, and power corrupts absolutely everybody in government.
Right. What happened? I mean, the whole goal, remember when we went into this thing, we said is to defend freedom. So now we have not only the destruction of freedoms here, we wind up treating Iraqis in a rather shabby manner over there. And if you've noticed, we're now moving into phase two of this whole operation. We were leaving phase one all across the board. We're leaving phase one behind, and we're now moving into phase two. And it's becoming ominous because what's happening is the sides are polarizing. Remember, the speeches we give over here is we say, well, we're going to combat evil around the world. And I keep thinking, funny. That's what most of these Islamists believe they're doing as well. Why do you think they call us the Great Satan? They didn't think this up one morning when they got out of bed. So each side believes it's fighting evil, and the things it's polarizing, it's threatening to spread now, and we find interesting little things. The Japanese are trying to make an oil deal with Iran because we know the next issue, and the one that we should look at tonight as well, is we have an entire cavalcade of economic crises on our doorstep that I'm predicting will look like a giant gut-wrenching slide into oblivion punctuated by explosions of economic chaos.
and that's the good news, huh?
And that's the good news,
right,
my gosh. But the oil crunch is coming. Cheap oil is gone. This $2 at the pump or better, depends on where you are in the country, is going to be the standard. That will be it. And so that's why it's interesting now they're trying to give people incentives to buy Humvees and gas-guzzling vehicles, things of that nature, because it's going to become prohibitive to drive these things in the near future.
Well, of course, I really think that they want to get the price of oil up. I think this is part of this whole idea of sustainable development and Agenda 21 and the Earth Charter. I think that they want to get us out of our cars. That has been the goal of the elitists, going back to the Club of Rome's book, The Limits of Growth, back in 1972. And this whole environmental movement, the purpose behind it is, of course, power and control over the individual. And the car represents freedom, and they don't want you to have any freedom. They want to make gasoline so expensive, you're not going to, by any manner or means, be able to afford oil and afford to drive your car. I think that they know exactly what they're doing, and they say, oh, the price of oil is going up, and we just don't have any refineries. Why don't we have any refineries? Well, because the environmental movement, has blocked their building. And who's funding the environmental movement? Why, many times, the great oil companies.
Well, it is combined. You know, it's funny, most people don't look at these. I call them multiple layers of reality. It's not that any one layer holds sway. It's that there are different levels of operation, and all of these things are in play at the same time. So it's going to be wild. Did you notice, by the way, the Fed and the Congress is backing away from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now because they're poised to go into crisis?
The whole housing market is going to just collapse here. It's only a matter of time. I just hope it'll hold out for 3 or 4 months.
Well, I mean, what am I saying? So we have, look at what we have. We have a coming, an oil crunch. That's why the Japanese are trying to do a deal with the Iranians. And that's what the whole issue. It's beginning to look like we're going to have global currency crises. And so there will be huge upward pressure on gold and silver, but they've got a switch in the deck, I'm convinced, in that one.
Don't you think that's what this new colored funny money is all about, so we can have a two-tiered money system down the line?
Yeah, what I think ultimately we have to do is we have to remember that huge amounts of our debt are owned by foreign investors. Huge amounts of treasury bills and other things are owned by foreign investors. And we have to find some way to lock that offshore and keep it from flooding back in here. Although, at the same time, inflation, by the way, is running wild. You know, the official figure is somewhere around 1.7%, which is absolute balderdash. I think the Christian Science Monitor calculated it at around 22-23%.
I put that in the same category as Donald Rumsfeld saying, we're just so sorry about what happened over there in those prisons. I put that in the same category as where they say the inflation rate's 1%. All you need to do is realize that when they calculate the inflation rate, they leave out the gasoline and the food and housing costs. And what they do is they rig the figures so that they always look good just going into the election. But, it's just sort of like Alice in Wonderland. That has nothing to do with reality.
And the funny part is anybody who really knows anything knows that. And the second funny part is the talking hairdos on television every night sit and talk as if these figures are real.
It's sort of like that old idea, are you going to believe your lying eyes or are you going to believe me here on the television screen?
Right, exactly. And it's you remember the old there was an old expression, do you want to talk to the guy in charge or the one who knows what's going on? and those are frequently two different people. And the same thing applies here. In the Soviet Union, everybody knew that Pravda and Izvestia were not telling you the truth. I mean, they just knew it. You knew that it was wrong. And here, over here, what the tragedy is a significant number of people still think that it's telling you the truth, and it's just not. There comes a point where I start throwing tomatoes at the television, because when you've done enough research, you realize that this is a big, it's not just a misunderstanding. It's a big, fat, bald, face lie.
But that's how you control the people. You tell them what you want them to believe, and it doesn't really matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, most people will believe. That's what's really so frightening to me, is most Americans still support this war in Iraq without realizing our boys aren't coming home. This is just the first in a series of wars in that area. It's all planned long ago, and very, very few people ever bother to go and look up the websites we tell them, like newamericancentury.org, and read about the plan back in 1998 for going to war with Iraq.
You know, it's interesting. You either have to chalk this off when you go all the way back. If you go back to what, say, starting with John Dewey and the elitists in education said they wanted to do, which was restructure society, remove Christianity as the base of the moral and the legal base, convert society into a socialist paradise whereby you have all the worker bees, et cetera, et cetera, and move on toward the environmental issues you talked about, you either have to come to a conclusion, all right, when later on, 20 and 30 years later, you see all of this stuff happening, either A, this is the greatest piece of random chance that ever existed in the history of the world, or B, there was some kind of a plan that was followed through because 40 years ago, they told you pretty well what they wanted to do. I was listening to one of the generals testifying today before the House. And by the way, the Senate was just absolutely brutal. The House isn't quite as bad. But anyway, the general was saying, well, we're in 146 countries now doing this and that and whatever.
Which would mean we have troops in 146 countries.
We have troops, right. In other words, doing maybe in small groups or advisors or whatever. But if you go back to freedom from war, remember that doctrine from the Kennedy administration about making the U.S. and Russia combined to become the world's police force and to disarm the entire world. My gosh, when you read this booklet, which came out 50 years ago, actually a little less than 50, but anyway, it's like we're following this plan. And again, you have to say, well, either this is random chance or there's sort of a long-term agenda that some group of people is following. And when you finally get X number of coincidences laid out, you suddenly realize this can't be chance, because it violates the number of permutations allowable. So that means that some greater agenda is following through here.
You're talking about, of course, State Department Report 77727, which came out in the early 1960s. I remember that very well. And it was called Freedom from War, and it was a plan, a master plan, to disarm the population, to cut back on the military throughout the world, and eventually just to have the only people who would have any military at all was the United Nations or the people they assigned, have troops throughout the world. The fact we have troops in 146 nations of the world. The average American doesn't realize that we have a greater empire than Rome ever did. And, of course, remember what happened to Rome. But there are people in our government who really want a Pax Americana. And they want to use America's military and financial power to force the whole world into this feudalistic system under a ruling elite, which will, of course, include the members of our administration. The trouble is that I fear that the Europeans, they want to be in charge, and I suspect that the communists and the Chinese would love to be in charge as well. I don't think any of them are going to be in charge.
It's interesting you say that, because for my show coming up Saturday, which I think you run next week, I just interviewed Georges Monbiot, who wrote the book Manifesto for a New World Order, Everything is in Place Except Our Consent. And he was the gentleman who wrote about 3 weeks ago talking about the wacky views of evangelicals who believe they're going to be, he calls them floating nudists taken up in the sky when Jesus comes back, that type of thing. And it was quite an abusive article published in The Guardian. Of course, The Guardian is sort of the publisher of all things left-wing and radical and crazy in Great Britain, and especially some of their environmental pronouncements. The latest story is from some head of environmentalism in Great Britain that we're all going to be sizzling in 20 years from now because the global warming will be so hot and the only place fit for us is Antarctica. So that's the kind of story they want. Anyway, I got Georges Monbiot and I thought this is going to be interesting. But, as I began to talk to the man, he and I and you would share a lot of the same views. He's concerned because he sees us moving into a new order composed of unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats in numerous offices who are making the laws that control our lives. And his argument is the fact that we're still not taking care of the poor, that this is really a big boys club, and he's really pretty right about that. But his answer is to form a world parliament that's directly elected by the people of the world, and his answers I don't think are very realistic. And so this is the new approach, and I've been chewing on this for a few days since we did the interview, wondering if we have a new opposite dialectic in here, which is we see the problems with the New World Order, and he uses that expression. This guy's a columnist in Great Britain. But we've got a different proposal. We'll make it good for you. You see that type of thing.
Well, that's because he doesn't understand these concepts of individual freedom under God, which separates our system of government from theirs. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is John Leffler, and if he sounds like he's in a barrel, he's on a cell phone, but it's getting better and better. It must be getting stronger, because your voice sounds clearer now than when we first got started. And John and I, for those of you who don't know who John Leffler is, why, he has his own radio program, which we broadcast on our radio station, and he has that on radio stations across the country. And when we get back from the break, we'll certainly want to tell you how you can, of course, get his radio program on a regular basis. But the important thing is that John is trying to bring out the fact that we are moving away from our traditional form of government. Our constitutional guarantees of freedom are being eroded right now. Of course, they're using the mythical threat of Islamic terrorism. Now, why do I say mythical threat? Very simply because our government doesn't believe that there's really a threat of Islamic terrorism. They just want us to believe that. If they really felt there was a threat of Islamic terrorism, they would have closed our borders. If they really thought that there was a threat of Islamic terrorism, they got $5 billion to go to local communities to protect them from a terrorist attack. They just can't get it out of the bureaucracy. So it's all sitting there in the government files someplace. $5 billion has been there about a year, but they just can't seem to get it out of the bureaucracy. Do you honestly believe that for one second? You know, if they really thought there was an Islamic threat, they would have every airplane pilot armed. They would have marshals on every airplane. They certainly would have protection against surface-to-air missiles on every airplane in America. They know there's no threat, but everything is perception. And you go through the little metal detector there at the airport, and you take off your shoes, and you are searched, and they have all these people doing this because they certainly wouldn't do that unless there was a threat, would they? Of course they would, because that's how they get you to believe there's a threat. And, of course, next newsletter will tell you exactly what happened on the morning of September 11th. You certainly won't miss that. But why don't you pick up the story from there, John?
You know, it's interesting we're moving in that direction because this whole thing is I try to get people to see this in multi-dimensions, because while there is an issue of, say, what we would call Islamic terrorism, understand that there's a war being fought against what people are being called extremist or intolerant, and that idea is there. And I've told people, I said, you really need to understand that there are certain groups of Jews and Christians that are next on this list once the time is ripe. And, of course, they'll look at you like you're an absolute idiot. And I'll say, well, but you just haven't been reading the right material, and I'm not talking about the right-wing extreme material. You need to go and read what some of the global elitists have been saying about religion and how this tolerance and diversity all fits in. I said, you just have to put a few strings together, and you can see where this is going to go very rapidly. Why? Because I said so? No, because they said so. And some people say, well, who is the they? That gets a little murky at times. We can identify certain people or others. Whenever you're dealing with an issue like this, with an enemy or any type of plot you're trying to figure out, you're always reasoning inductively rather than deductively. And so the facts don't become obvious except en route. But as I said, you go back and say, well, what were the elitists saying 40 years ago? Well, we needed a global government. We needed to restructure society. We needed to dumb down education. We need to convert education from a place where people are educated into a place where they become worker bees or they're socialized, et cetera, et cetera. You can find this as just a wealth of material in the literature that very few of the public ever reads, telling you the general direction we were going. And as Marilyn Ferguson...
Hold that thought right there for a moment. We'll pull our stations right back. Okay, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is John Leffler, and he's talking about the fact that the elitists have been talking a long time about the fact they're going to have to eliminate the Christians and the Jews, and that they really have a plan. And if you read their writings, they will tell you exactly what they're going to do. But you're never going to hear this from Rush Limbaugh, Dan Rather, Bill O'Reilly, or certainly any of the other major mainline communicasters. So you pick up the story from there, John.
Yeah, and it's important to realize, you know, as I always emphasize to people, I say, well, what's the difference between a conspiracy and an agenda? And this is important, because Marilyn Ferguson made this type of a point in her book, The Aquarian Conspiracy, back in 1980, as an insider. A conspiracy is where guys plot in secret to beat you over the head with a baseball bat. An agenda is where two or three or four guys plan to hit you over the head with a baseball bat. Then they write lots of articles and give speeches in coded words about how they're going to hit you over the head with a baseball bat. They will deny publicly that they're going to hit you over the head with a baseball bat. And when you wake up in the hospital and said, well, we wrote speeches and articles about it 10 years ago. Didn't you write the article? Didn't you read the articles? You know, that's an agenda.
Well, I think anybody who wants to know what the plan is for Christians, you need to read the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report that came out of the Second Earth Summit in Rio. That's in 1992. And here they talk about the threats to this wonderful new utopian sustainable world they're talking about. And they say, and anybody would like to see this page, the summary, we'd be glad to send it to you. They say the real threat to this world is the monotheistic religions, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews. And the inference there, as you read this thing, is they've got to be eliminated because these people have values and they don't want to get back to the real religion, which is, of course, the worship of the rocks and the trees and the pantheistic religion that they're pushing in this. This comes out of a report that was put together under the auspices of the most wealthy and powerful people in the world, the members of the Prince of Wales Business Council, which met on the good ship Britannia, the Prince of Wales yacht, either early in 1990. Or late in 1991, the plan, what the Rio Earth Summit would come up with, what the major issues were. So it's all laid out there, and you can get it from your local bookstore for about $60 or $70, Global Biodiversity Assessment, or we'll be glad to send you the pages out of that where they talk about this sort of thing. You read the writings of Barbara Marx Hubbard, and she says, you know, there's a quarter of the world that won't evolve to a higher level of consciousness, and it's very obvious she's talking about Christians because she hates Christians. Her book, The Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation, was channeled to her by what she calls the Christ spirit. I think it was the demonic spirit. But she talks about how that one quarter that won't evolve to a higher level are going to have to be eliminated. And she goes on to say, that is not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse death, referring to Revelation 6:8. So it's all there. All you need to do is get it and read it. They have a plan. They intend to eliminate the large parts of the world population, whether it be Jacques Cousteau wants to eliminate 350,000 people a day, or Sam Keen, speaking at the State of the World Forum, Dr. Sam Keen, back in 1994, I think it was, when he said, you know, we'd eliminated 90% of the world's population, there wouldn't be enough people around to do much damage, and his remarks were met with applause.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hard part, as I've always said. How, if we're wrong, how is it we've been so able to tell you ahead of time where things are going to go? You know, the scenario that's unfolding in Iraq right now is exactly what Dennis Cuddy predicted. He again, did his research, went through it, and said, okay, here's where they're going with this thing. And sure enough, it's going to erupt in all these little local chiefdoms and fiefdoms doing their thing in Iraq, yada, yada, yada. So, and if you talk to people that are honest on the inside of these things, as occasionally I can do, they're pretty honest about it. They're not afraid of you going public or anything because nobody believe them. You know, nobody will believe you when you do that. So, but this is it. I mean, we said back in, 2001, the beginnings of World War III are here. And let me give you one of the classic scenarios, and that is, we're headed into horrible currency crunches. We have never seen the bottom of this so-called recession because no debt was blown off. We have an oil crunch coming, a baby boom crunch. When you get into these type of things, what do? You do what the Argentines did back in the early 1980s. You start a war. And that is classic. It's almost a historical curve that when we get to this point in economy, we begin having conflict and warfare. It goes back hundreds and hundreds of years.
And I would say that there's no way that CBS2 would have ever put out those pictures of the torture in the prisons in Iraq. They would have been allowed to do that by the government if it had not been exactly what the establishment wants. They want to inflame the Arabs throughout the world. And, of course, there are about 1.5 billion Arabs there. And when they're mad enough, you can expect a tremendous blowback from people overseas, from people here in America. I really fear for my country. And perhaps this will be God's justice on what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon, or this evening, is John Loeffler of Steel on Steel. And when we get back, I'm going to have him tell you how you can listen to Steel on Steel and get his material, because I guarantee it's some of the most insightful material available in the country. You know, when you talk to people that were coming into a currency crisis, they look and they say, gee, the stock market's staying up, things are good. You know, the latest reports show that the job market is looking good. Production is up, productivity is up, things are really looking better than they ever have. Isn't that true, John?
Well, on the surface they are, I guess, but jobs are not up. We're pretty stagnant in the jobs category. You really have to disregard all of the government figures. And so when anybody's telling you jobs are doing better, that's just bull.
Well, you know, this old idea that that people are always making up statistics, and they do. They just sort of make them up out of thin air, and they put them out as if they're official government policy or the official government findings. But they always do this just before an election, because whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in power, they want the people to be fat, dumb, and happy. And the Federal Reserve System always goes along with this, because they certainly don't care whether the Republicans or the Democrats in. They just don't want the people ever to think that maybe there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two major policies, two major parties.
There isn't a dime's worth of difference. You say tomorrow John Kerry were to be elected president, very little would change. And that's something that nobody has noticed, is that no matter who you put in office, the agenda tends to roll forward. We would still continue with a war. We would still continue on the trail to where he would try to raise taxes through the Congress. But that's not going to fly either. Raising taxes right now is going to become political suicide. Right now there's a lot of bravado about that. But right now people are pretty well tapped out. They're chasing inflation down one side, and if people think that they can raise, and there are some, I mean, there are, you know, your state legislature in California thinks that it's going to tax the bejeebers out of everybody to balance its budget. Well, I've got news for them. The money producers and everything, large numbers of people are leaving the state.
No, those are the people with money. Those are the people who would be paying the big capital gains, because you can move over to Nevada and not pay any capital gains.
Right, and that's what they're doing. They're establishing primary residence in Nevada or elsewhere. This area where I live in northern Idaho is being kept alive by California money. We have about one in every two people you run into now is from somewhere in California in the last 5 years. So, and that's why this area we're booming up here. I mean, absolutely booming, because of the housing constructions are just incredible from a place that a decade ago was a sleepy little corner of the country. Incredible.
Hold that thought just a moment here. Well, our guest this evening is John Loeffler, and he's just saying that, of course, where he lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, it's really booming because all the people are moving there from California. They're getting out of California. These are the people who have any money. Of course, a lot of people are coming in who don't have any money, but it's going to be pretty hard to get, you know, blood out of a turnip. It's going to be hard to get money out of people who aren't making much of anything or don't have anything. So before we go on, John, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your ministry, with Steel on Steel.
Well, if they would like what I do for your listeners around the world, is they can go to our website at steelonsteel.com. That's one word, steelonsteel.com. And if they want to listen to our shows, I'll get this going after the show tonight, they can click on a radio show to listen. It's usually a $6 a month subscription, but we'll give them a 30-day free trial. If they just use the word Stan for the login and password for both of those, they'll be able to listen to shows. And I'm just using the techniques of a good drug peddler.
you want them to get hooked on listening to Steel on Steel.
I want them to get hooked on the show and say, well, I guess this is worth it. Because we're even changing the model of how we do radio. I'm looking more at different modes of delivery and things of that nature. It's going to be real interesting as the economy implodes. Christian broadcasting is going to be really endangered, because historically, in hard times, those are the incomes that get chopped to ministries. We saw that after Y2K, is there was just a tremendous downturn in giving to ministries. And then that affects how many ministries can buy time on Christian stations. Ironically, that's one of the things that David Wilkerson predicted in his book Division back in 74. He said when the global recession finally hits in, it's going to buckle all but a few of the Christian radio ministries. So we're trying to develop different models as to how to keep this type of thing afloat.
Well, I know one of my friends that does actually carry our programs. We give him a couple hundred dollars a month to carry them on his two radio stations. But he was telling me that he's owed over $50,000. And he said you'd be surprised at some of the major Christian radio ministries, and they're just not paying their bills. And this was about a month ago. So I think the squeeze is already on. I think we are just so blessed to be able to continue doing what we're doing.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's going to be... These are going, you know, I don't mean to panic everybody. I guess what I'm doing is ringing a bell and saying it really is that bad, but that's okay. The reason we're talking about it is people can understand what's happening. If you understand what's happening, then you're in a position to deal with that on a personal level. You know, if you are in a job, people say, well, what can the little guy do? If you don't have investments, say you don't have large blocks of silver or stocks or commodities or whatever. Well, there are things you can do. You can try to move into a profession that will be needed during this time. Services, various service industries or things of that nature. You can hedge your budget in the right direction, pay off something, get out of debt. There are all sorts of things that you can do if you understand where it's going. And the whole bottom line is neither you nor I have control over this thing. And we wind up praying. I wind up saying, okay, God, you know, you got us this far. Show us what the next step is. And everyone can do that because we all have different circumstances. There's no reason why we should be panicking. Frankly, I have this perverse sense that every newsman does, Dr. Stan, and I've been doing news work since 1965 for radio stations mostly. But you get this perverse pleasure when things are all snapping around you because it gives you lots to do. And so even in San Francisco when I work for KCBS, we kept a little plaque up on the wall with the number of people who jumped from the Golden Gate Bridge, and then we had a little one underneath it, dividing it into the number that lived and the number that died. Now, this is sort of a newsman's outlook, you know. But at the same time, God always promises to get us through anything that we go through if we just simply look at Him and trust Him. Now, there are two sides to that. Some people say, well, I trust Him, and I'm just going to sit here and coast. That's probably not a good idea. The other side is to panic, and I don't think either one of those is there. But it really is going to be a rough time. We've been saying that for, what, 3 or 4 years now? Since you and I and a few others who have spotted the paradigm shift years before it would happen. I remember calling you in 2001, or was it 2002, I think, and I said, unless I'm reading it right, there's been a major paradigm change here, and things are about to change radically. This is before we went into Iraq. Because if you understand what's happening, then you can read the signs real clearly when they come about. And we're in a new paradigm shift. I haven't quite figured out what it all means, but we've just gone through another profound change. We're into the next phase, Dr. Stan.
No, I think we are. I really do. Well, let's go to John, who's calling us from Post Falls, Idaho, up in your neighborhood there. Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, gentlemen. I just wanted to invite your comments regarding the emergence of the Bill Bennett and Tony Snow show. And I find this very curious timing, given that Bush seems to have some attacks on his flanks. So what do you think about that?
All right. Would you like to comment on that, John? And then I'll give my thoughts.
I haven't seen it, so I don't have any thoughts on it.
All right. Well, let me tell you, John, if you go to the website at newamericancentury.org and look at the 25 people in the this little cabal that's planned the Iraqi war, one of them just happened to be William Bennett. And, of course, he is part of this little group that is pushing this neoconservative agenda of getting us into war after war after war and dominating the world. So, obviously, they're going to put him on radio or television to try to shore up the current administration, of which their group controls. There's only 25 of them. Maybe they picked up a few people down the line. But they're the people who control the administration and have certainly made mockery out of this concept of representative government. And for the skeptic out there, the website, newamericancentury.org, and you can read the whole incredible story of how everything was scripted ahead of time. Anything
well,
else, John?
It was not only scripted. I mean, it was obviously planned. The hard questions are never asked, never answered, and even about the whole bit about weapons of mass destruction, that's just such a side, unimportant issue because there's a much bigger agenda playing out. I mean, that should be the question if you plan to go into Iraq ahead of time. What's up?
Sure.
You know, why are we doing this?
And I think that we have, of course, the project for the New American Century agenda. But I think that there are other agendas out there. I think there's a spiritual component to this whole thing. And whether the members of that organization realize it or not, they are being used by this spiritual agenda, which wants the death, wants the horror of World War III. And I really believe that there are people or forces or spiritual forces that are moving us towards this terrible, terrible conflict. Anything else, John, up there in Post Falls?
Well, gentlemen, having sampled both shows, I must say I'm quite disappointed because I had hoped that there'd be a little bit of independent thought, but they appear to be Hannity Limbaugh clones and just more of the same. And as John said, they're not asking the hard questions on the Tony Snow Show or the Bill Bennett Show.
But they never will. You see, if you want to get the hard questions, you ask here on Radio Liberty or on Steel on Steel. Okay, God bless. Thanks.
Hey,
so much.
Thank you.
Now let's go to Ari calling from Redwood City. Hi, Ari. How you doing?
Dan, and hi, John.
Howdy.
I've got a question about the real estate bubble. If property values fall by a large amount, a third or a half, let's say, there are going to be a lot of homeowners who owe more on their mortgage than their house is worth.
Right.
What happens in that situation? Does the lender demand that you pay the difference immediately so that they can still have a secured loan? As long as you keep making the payment?
No, the problem that the lender will have at that point, and I've been trying to figure out how they get around it, if they were isolated ones, that would be a matter of your loan agreement and the bank policy. But in this case, remember there's an old expression, if you owe the bank a little, they own you. If you owe the bank a lot, you own them. And in this case, they're going to have large numbers of people who can't pay their mortgages, who will literally just walk away from them. They won't care what the bank demands or anything else. They're just going to walk away. Because, remember, the dollar's becoming worthless right now as we watch it. We're heading towards a hyperinflationary scenario. And as a matter of fact, what may actually happen is, because of the fact we're moving into hyperinflation, it's probably the only way we're going to get out of the Social Security conundrum.
What if you want to keep your house? I mean, what choices do you have? Are they going to ask you to come up with some money?
No. The thing is, as long as you make your monthly payments, that's all right. I mean, that's not going to be the problem. The problem is going to be the fellow who, got 100% financing on a $500,000 house. He's got nothing invested in the house. He's making his monthly payments. And then, of course, the value of the house drops to about $200,000, and this guy loses his job. What happens to the house? He can't make the payments. He gives it to the bank or the Fannie Mae. Probably it's Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac that'll end up owning the house. And now they've got a $500,000 loan on their books. They got a house that's worth $200,000, and suddenly Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are insolvent. And then what happens? And then this begins to cascade. And this is what happened to the banks over in Japan. You know, the property value in the city of Tokyo, it was said, was greater than the value of all the property in the United States a couple of years ago. And when their bubble burst, they ended up, these banks would have a property, worth 10 cents on the dollar that they had lent on it. And that's why it took them 10 years to get out of the mess that they were in. And this is, I believe, what's going to happen here. And we have a wonderful opportunity to pick up property very, very cheaply. I've heard that Sir John Templeton, the very, very famous investor, had made the remark, don't buy a house now. Wait till they get down to about 20% of what they're costing today.
That's his prediction
right.
for the U.S. market?
Right.
Wow.
Right. So anyway, hang on to your hats, Harry. We're in for a ride. Just get yourself out of debt so that no matter what happens, you can survive and you can make the payments on your house. And at least you want to be able to keep the place where you live in.
Yeah, I intend to.
Okay, God bless you.
Thanks
so much.
Bye-bye.
Oh, would you have any thoughts at all on what I just said, John?
Yeah, a number of things are going to happen because of the same deal. You're going to have large numbers of properties which people will be absolutely willing to walk away from. So if all things were being equal, they may come up with a new, called the National Housing Administration or the National Home Security Administration or something, and they'll buy the property from the banks, and in exchange for that, you pay rent to the government. That's one scenario, okay? Other scenario is the bank will do what they can to keep you in there, And if the money's going to inflate, I mean, Jim Poplava, I think, is pretty well figuring we're going towards hyperinflation and a currency crisis. That's his latest call. If we do that, your house payment is going to be dribble compared to what you're going to have to make just to stay even. Because basically, as the size of your budget will have to go way, 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 way up just to break even in the hyperinflationary environment. So you'll be paying your house off with inflated dollars, even if you'll never make back what it is you pay into it. So it might be better for people just to stay in it. See, all these things have variables stacked on them. You follow what I'm talking about?
Well, now, does Heath feel that we will have hyperinflation followed by by deflation, or does he think that we'll just have hyperinflation and then we'll just destroy the value of the currency?
I think he believes right now we're going to destroy the value of the currency. He believes most of the world's currencies are headed towards some kind of a major crisis. He's really been agonizing over this for the 2 years I've been doing the show with him on Financial Sense News Hour about which way this thing is going to go. And he said just the indicators seem to be a hyperinflation, which is why, by the way, if you notice, Alan Greenspan was urging people to get into variable rate mortgages.
Now that, of course, how you really get into trouble. And when he suggested that people get into variable rate mortgages, what he's basically saying is get the 4% now, and then when it goes up to 30%, you're not going to be able to do anything about it.
Right. Well, basically, he wants to, because he understands that hyperinflation is going to go, they'll ratchet the percentage rate up sooner or later to match it, and people will be paying approximately the same in buying power for their houses. What has happened now is with all of the refis out there, everybody's refied their house at or below, 5%, somewhere around there, and they're fixed rate mortgages, which means that people will be paying these balances off with ever inflated amounts of money. And so they see this coming, and these mortgages become worth less and less and less and less to the bank. So it's a strange set of interacting figures, and depending on which way things actually go will determine the final outcome on that.
Well, I could suggest do not take Alan Greenspan's advice. I think it would be suicidal to change from a fixed-rate loan to a variable-rate loan. You would have to have your head examined at least by 3 psychiatrists to explain why anybody would do something that stupid.
No, absolutely, because right now, for any liquid credit that's left out there, if we go in a hyperinflationary environment, as you have to make more and more and more money to stay par with the inflation, you'll be paying off loans with just incredibly inflated dollars.
Well, you know what they're doing now is really so incredible. I had a real estate friend of mine tell me that he is selling houses now with nothing down.
Yes.
All you have to do is simply start making your monthly payments. You have absolutely nothing invested in the house. He is buying a house, and when he buys the house, he gets $25,000 because the house will be appraised at $25,000 higher than the price he's going to pay. So what will happen is that the house will be financed at $25,000 more than he's paying for it. So by buying the house, he makes $25,000, and he can walk away tomorrow. But what happens to the bank or the lending institution that's holding that loan if the value of that house, that loan, if the value of the house begins to fall at some time in the future? There's the only reason that they would do something like that is they feel that we're going to just continue blowing off this inflationary bubble. But every inflationary bubble eventually collapses.
Right, it does. Now, some parts of the country may do well as people flee. Like if the California bubble would have burst prematurely, people would be bailing out of the markets there and trying to get into to other states and things like that. So it might have a temporary redistributionary effect. But over the whole, the market's overinflated. We know that. Sooner or later, it's got to peel out. I don't know. It's going to be wild times. And it should be pointed out, all this is caused by really one thing, Dr. Stan, and it's the fact that we don't have our currency anchored in anything stable like gold or other fixed assets that prevent all of this manipulation and monkeying that's been going on ever since John Keynes and his friends got their hands into the currency. Actually, even going back earlier than that, going back to the Federal Reserve Bank, where they were able to slowly move us off the gold standard and then off the silver standard, always saying, we're older, wiser, we know better now, we've grown up, we've come of age. We have a system. We can do it. Those are all the promises, you know. And anyone who opposes that is always ridiculed as being backwards. And see, the issue that we have right now with all of the stuff you see on the tube, etc. It's not that we don't have a problem. It's the fact that the people who are on the tube and who teach in many of our universities have themselves staked careers on Keynesian economics. The problem is the system. And they think just by tinkering they can make it better. You can't. The system has to be scrapped.
And the problem is that when you have a system where banks can create money out of absolutely nothing, where you have a system where the central bankers are able, as Professor Quigley says on page 324 of his classic book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, where the central bank can create a feudalistic system by which they're able to control the population, you have a ruling elite that creates money out of everything, out of nothing, they buy up the industries, they buy up the newspapers, they buy up the competing banks, and they really control the society. In fact, I was just rereading that classic article, the classic letter that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, wrote to Colonel House in 1933. I found it among Colonel House's papers back at the Sterling Library at Yale, where the President of the United States says, the real truth of the matter is, as both you and I know, that financial elements in the larger centers has owned the government's since the administration of Andrew Jackson, and I'm not totally excluding the administration of WW, referring to Woodrow Wilson. Anybody who'd like to see that letter would be glad to send you a copy of it. The president realized that the bankers controlled the government of the United States. It's about time maybe the American people understood that. They've created a bubble. They prospered greatly themselves, but the day of reckoning is coming, and it's coming very soon.
Well, now, they could have had a steady burn prosperity, but instead chose to live the prosperity of the future generations. And the future generations will now be asked to pay for it. Unless, of course, you just abolish this whole system, which would never happen. I'm pipe dreaming now. And put us back on something stable. That would mean that the people who have profited from the crookedness of the system would have to forego their profits and their prerogatives and things of that nature. And I don't think they're about to do that. You know, that's not going to happen. I'm a realist. I understand how this thing works.
Well, let's go to Paul calling in from Huntington Beach. Paul, we're almost out of time, but do you have a question?
Okay, well, first of all, you definitely do want an adjustable rate because the adjustable is wholesale and fixed rates are retail. Anyone with any sense knows that. Anyway, if you think we're coming into hyperinflation, why on earth would you want to get out of debt now? That makes no sense.
All right, then why don't you answer that, John?
You know, I was thinking that as I was talking about that because of the fact that the longer you wait, you would want to stay into it because
absolutely
you'd be paying it off with more and more inflated dollars.
That's right.
However, you can't be sure that's the way that they're going, and you can't be sure that they're going to make the game, the rules of the game are going to be the same tomorrow as they are today.
All right, Paul, I'll tell you why I think that you should get out of debt, because I think that usually after you go into a hyperinflation, then you go into a deflation, and if you lose your job, you lose your house. So I would try at least to have your house well taken care of. I would not want to be in debt, because these are extremely uncertain times, and I know what's happened in the past. If you go into hyperinflation, eventually that has to stop. When that stops, and I saw that back in 1980, we've seen it before, when they jack the interest rates up so high that they actually just cut off the economy altogether. And at that point, people really begin to lose their jobs, and I fear that an awful lot of people are going to lose their houses. That's why I try to get out of debt. Okay.
Yeah, the one question that I asked Paul is, you know, okay, so one's retail, the other's wholesale. A big so what? The bottom line is, are you going to be able to service the payment when the interest rate balloons up?
Okay, we're out of time. God bless you both. Thanks for calling, Paul, and thanks so much for being with us, John. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're primarily dependent upon those people who listen to our programs to help us so that we can continue bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind this story. And I would simply point out that the views we express here are simply suggesting to people we're in very, very difficult times. I'm not a financial advisor, nor is John, but I've been studying what's going on for 42 years now. If any of you would like to understand the economics of what's happening, we have a book we offer called Fiat Money Inflation in France. It was written over 150 years ago by the dean of the Yale University, Andrew Dickinson White, about what had happened at the time following the French Revolution. They got into an inflationary spiral at that time. And as you read that book, talking about an era over 200 years ago, it's like deja vu all over again. If you'd like to, you can want to know more about the book, Fiat Money Inflation in France. It's a simple little inexpensive book, but it will give you tremendous insight into what's happened in the past when they've gone into a paper currency that had no backing, that of course was issued by the government, and the government would always want to have more and more and money more issued, then till eventually why the whole economic system collapsed. The same thing happened in the Weimar Republic. The same thing has happened down throughout the ages. So, but Fiat Money Inflation in France is one of the most astute little books we have. We also offer that along with Bastiat's The Law. You can get one or you can get both of them. But these two books will give you tremendous insight into what's going on today. But Bastiat's The Law was written in 1848. Fiat Money in France was written probably in the late 1880s, somewhere in there. It was written probably about 100 years after the French Revolution and the inflationary spiral that followed that. So then we hope many of you will want to get our book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which goes into the spiritual forces behind everything, because I believe behind the best laid plans of mice and men are spiritual forces. Behind the people within the Project for the New American Century, many of these people may honestly believe exactly what they're doing is right. We need American imperialism. We need America to lead the world. But I think they're being manipulated by spiritual forces as well. And so if you'd be interested, let me recommend my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Let me recommend my video, Iraq, the Untold Story, which goes into the origin of all of the wars of the last century. They were all manipulated. And there was a common goal and a common purpose behind World War I, the war to end all wars, the war to make the world safe for democracy. Behind World War II, behind Vietnam, behind Korea, behind the first Gulf War, now the second Gulf War. And that is the move towards a one world government and a new world religion. That's the common denominator behind literally everything going on today. So if you'd like to know more about the books we've mentioned, Fiat Money Inflation in France, Bastiat's The Law, The Brotherhood of Darkness, the video, Iraq, the Untold Story, and there is a syllabus that comes along with that, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you would like to get a free copy of our newsletter, either the March newsletter, which tells you about the secret meetings in the White House in January and February of the year 2001, 7 to 8 months before the 9/11 attack, or if you would like to get our latest newsletter, which is, of course is a critique of the 9/11 Commission investigation, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll be glad to send you a free copy of our newsletter, and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until, well, we'll be back here this next hour, but for those of you who are leaving us, until Monday, we'll be with you again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring, because we have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for the few minutes, because we have with us on the line, coming from, Gus Stelzer. Gus is formerly an executive for General Motors, and at one time he was in charge of sales on the West Coast. How large an organization did you have working for you at that time, Gus?
Well, in the last 10 years I was with GM, I had 2,100 people on my own payroll, and then I was in charge of over 1,000 dealers, mostly in the western half of the country, with another 35,000 employees, all of whom my organization had to train and manage and make sure that the 1,000 dealers maintained a profitable business and got proper market share and handle all the lawsuits that went with it.
And, of course, General Motors was a great company at that time. As they used to say, that what's good for General Motors is good for America.
Well, the statement has been twisted. Engine Charlie Wilson appeared before a congressional committee, and he was asked what his opinion was with regard to the relationship of General Motors and America. And he said, what is good for America is good for GM and vice versa.
Right.
But the press picked it up, and they twisted it, and they said what is good for GM is good for America.
Okay, so it was really what's good for America.
What Engine Charlie Wilson said. And it's been gone down in history since then. That was back in the late 1950s, and that erroneous statement is still being repeated.
All right. Well, I'm glad you clarified that for us. But certainly General Motors was one of the major engines of our economy. And, of course, the automobile, both General Motors and Ford, Chrysler, they produced a lot of products. They had a lot of jobs. They were sort of equated with America. America was a wonderful nation where you could have a home and a car, or maybe even two cars. In fact, that's always sort of been the objective. You know, what was Hoover said? The two cars in every garage and a chicken in every pot. And of course, after the Depression came, it was two chickens in every garage. But certainly at one time, why the car was the foundation of much of our economy. Well, what we're going to talk this evening about what's happening as far as NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, tearing down our tariff boundaries, and this myth of free trade, that somehow free trade is going to stimulate our economy, that we've got all these people over in China we can sell to, all those people in Mexico we can sell to, and if we just are willing to have this closing down of many of our industries or having them leaving this country, we're going to have all sorts of new jobs here, and the good times are going to roll under free trade. So you want to pick up the story from there, Gus?
Well, yes, Dr. Stan and your listeners, just in a capsule, there is no such thing as free trade. Certainly there is not within the United States. We are not a free market economy. Every dollar of production and commerce in this country is saturated with the tremendous costs of federal, state, and local regulations and tax burdens, all of which account for about 80% of the cost of the average American product. So there is no free trade within the United States. That's a delusion that's being held by many people that think we're a free enterprise and so on. That just isn't true. It means that you're just a homeowner and you don't pay your property taxes. Pretty soon you'll find out that you don't own your home anymore. Now when it comes to commerce across our borders, I think honest people will generally acknowledge that every participant in a competitive activity should play by the same rules. You know, for example, if you're sitting at a table at a poker game in Las Vegas and the dealer says it's a five-card draw and a $100 ante, nobody is allowed to enter the game and reach for the jackpot with only a $5 or a $10 ante. There's only one activity, only one competitive activity in which the rules are not the same for every participant, even though the lives of millions of people and trillions of dollars are involved, and that is within this arena of free trade, because we have a double standard that we allow stuff to come in from other countries into this country that are made under conditions that violate practically every American law and every tax law, and we have a sad situation where we have legislators, especially at the federal level, who pass all kinds of laws which have a cost consequence, and then they turn around and invite foreigners to send their products in this country in violation of the very laws that they passed before. So when you get to the bottom line on this whole issue, what we are confronted with is a terrible breakdown in moral comprehension. It is morally wrong to engage in free trade across our borders, which has the effect of double-crossing honest, law-abiding people in this country and putting millions of people out of work. And since 1971, I have documented that over 40 million Americans have lost their jobs because of our trade policies. And the list of damages that has gone on, as a matter, in 1971, for example, we had a national debt of only $408 billion. Now, I say only, that's quite a bit, but that was after some 190-some-odd years in which we were operating since the Constitution was drafted. But since that time, we've added nearly $7 trillion of national debt, and so we now have a national debt that the last figures I had is about 7.2 or $7.3 trillion, and 95% of all of that national debt is due to our trade policies. So this is really a tragic thing, not only from the standpoint of numbers and dollars, but also a tragedy with respect to what it has done to the American people.
Well, you know, one of the things that really disturbs me is we hear all this about equitable trade or free trade or fair trade, I think is that the term that they use, but other countries are looking after their vested interests. Other countries are going to block our imports coming in and competing with theirs. And, they're not allowing our cars to go into Japan. They're not allowing our cars to go into China. They can always find some bureaucratic problem or bureaucratic justification for making to come in. I think we sold something like maybe 60 General Motors cars in China that were manufactured in the United States, but large numbers of Chinese cars now are coming into the United States because we don't have any barriers to keep them out. We're welcoming all these imports because they're cheap, and yet, of course, our exports are certainly not meeting the anywhere near like our imports, and that's why we are going to have a export deficit of about half a trillion dollars this year, about $500 billion, half a trillion dollars more that we are importing than we're exporting, and because the other countries are looking after their country, they're looking after their people, it would appear that our leaders have a different agenda, and that is to redistribute the wealth of the middle class of America.
Well, what's involved here, Stan, is a question of sovereignty and maintaining control of our own destinies. When, after the Constitution was ratified, in the very first Congress, they passed laws to establish what was called the tariff system. And for all of the years of that 19th century through the 1800s, tariffs on our imports furnished about 85% of the revenue needed to run our federal government. And during those roughly 123 years up to 1910, there were about four or five occasions when the free traders attempted to depart from the tariff system, and whenever they did, the economy worsened. So they went back to what was called the tariff protectionist system, and the economy improved. And that's a matter of record that's well documented. I have several books that describe that. But then in 1910 or 1913, President Wilson was conned into abandoning that tariff system to provide the revenue for the government. They abandoned the tariffs on imports, and they put a tariff on American goods. Now, when I say tariff on American goods, that might be a statement that's hard to understand, but we have to understand that an income tax is a tariff.
I see. Now, is that the first, the beginning of the corporate taxes here in the United States?
That was in 1913,
right,
when there were corporate taxes as well as individual taxes, and the taxes at that time were only 2%. And on a small percentage of the individual population. And in 1910, before the income tax law was passed, the per capita tax burden in this country was only $6.95. That's federal, state, and local. And a couple of years ago, that tax burden has sailed past $10,500 per capita. And all of that is a tariff.
Well, you know, I think it was so clever what they did. You know, when they were passing the income tax, they said, oh, this is only for the very wealthy. These people who have so much money, and why shouldn't they share just a little of their money with the poor people who need it so much, and think how much it would help the poor people. And we're not going to put a limit on the amount of the taxes, because if we were to put a limit, it would probably go up to, say, 3% if we put a limit on 3%. So we'll keep it far less than that, but this is the only equitable thing to do. And with this idea of taxing the rich, you know, this politics of envy, they sold this to the American people, who never understood that this was never intended for the wealthy. It was always intended as a vehicle of controlling the middle class, and this is exactly where it is today. The very poor don't pay any taxes, and the very rich have means of getting around paying the taxes and passing it on to future generations through setting up trust and all, and it's primarily a tax on the middle class, which of course is increasingly being impoverished, and of course on the corporations as well. But of course, many of our major corporations just don't bother to pay any taxes, especially if they move overseas. Why, they are exempted for paying taxes here in the United States. Isn't that nice? It's almost as if we are subsidizing our major corporations to move overseas.
Well, Stan, I have a kind of a view on this. I believe that if we're going to be a sovereign nation, we ought to act like one, and we ought to control our own destinies. I don't quarrel with other countries putting up barriers or putting up tariffs on the stuff that we try to export to them. I think that's the duty of a government to control and regulate the imports that come into their country.
Of course it is. But those countries are looking after their economies and their people. Our leaders have no loyalty to this country. They seem to have a loyalty to this globalist dream.
That's because our political people, under the control of the Wall Street crowd and the financial people, they have lost control of our own destinies. For example, there's been a lot of criticism of China recently about things that they're doing wrong as a result of this $124 to $130 billion trade deficit we've got going with them. And so we've got Secretary of Treasury John Snow putting the pressure on them to devalue their currency. That's a cop-out. We have the right to establish a tariff on Chinese goods coming into this country. And if we think there is some imbalance or something wrong with the pricing of products from China coming into this country, we ought to impose a tariff on it to make up the difference. Now, the fact that we don't is a de facto acknowledgement by our own government that they have lost control of our country. We have the right to establish the tariff. And that's the way it was for the first 123 years after the Constitution was drafted. But we have totally abandoned the duty and responsibility in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, I think it's Clause 3, that Congress is supposed to regulate commerce with foreign nations in order to form a more perfect union, as is spelled out in the preamble. But they're not doing that. And somebody said that we have a parliament of whores in Washington, and I think that's about how sad our situation has become. If we have time here, Stan, there is a development that occurred yesterday that I think indicates just how sickening the leadership of our country has become, and that involved a talk made by Alan Greenspan. Have you heard of that?
No, why don't you tell us about that? I've been on the road for the last couple of days, so I haven't been able to keep up with the news.
Do you have a minute?
Sure, you've got about 4 minutes.
Okay, well, yesterday, Thursday, Alan Greenspan gave a talk over satellite to a group of banking people out of a conference that was scheduled out of the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago. And the basic headline out of it was that the headline, and this comes from an Associated Press dispatch that I'm looking at here right now, it said, Greenspan says the bill for soaring deficits will soon come due. And then the words were, he said, America's soaring federal budget deficit represents a major obstacle to long-term U.S. economic stability. Then he went on to say that he cautioned against being lulled into a false sense of security about the deficit or America's low savings rate or the nation's trade deficit, just because these problems have not yet triggered rising interest rates or a steep fall in the value of the dollar. Well, now, right there, he has made a terrible mistake. The value of the dollar has already declined 40% against the euro. It's declined 25% against the Japanese yen. And on a, what they call a trade-weighted basis, it's down about 25% of all the nations that we trade with. So he's brushing aside the declining value of our dollar, and we have to understand that the primary reason for the declining value of our dollar is that we are flooding the world with $500 billion of our dollars last year and this year, and we're doing it at a rate again next year in a form that's called a trade deficit. And a trade deficit is a forfeiture of production, which is the only thing that creates wealth and tax revenue. At the same time, it's a forfeiture of our currency. It's a double whammy. We lose both ways, coming and going. And yet, Mr. Greenspan says that the trade deficit doesn't worry him. And he made a statement something to the effect that the imbalances haven't reached a point yet where the free lunch is still to be invented. We've been on a free lunch program in this country for at least 50 years. And the free lunch program, if I could describe it, is basically this. As a result of millions of regulatory laws and tax laws that are the result of demands by the electorate and the legislators pass these laws, which create all of these great costs, so we have a nice country, and the state of California certainly is typical of that. And so, after all these costs are imposed on the American working people and American producing industries, the American people are encouraged to not pay for it at the consumer counter. And I liken this to walking into a very fancy restaurant, you could call it a Ritz-Carlton, and having a gourmet lunch, and it's a lovely place, everything is fine, but then you walk out without paying for it. And so we've been on a free lunch program now for some 50 years, and every year the trade deficit situation gets worse.
Well, now, what did Alan Greenspan suggest that needed to be done?
Yes,
he wants to, just to cut the massive budget deficit, or that he's not so concerned about the trade deficit, but he is concerned about the budget deficit?
Well, he has two things. Number one, he has no concern about the trade deficit, and he says, in his remarks, he says, that will be corrected by market forces. That's a lot of baloney. This man knows better than that.
Well, I know he does.
He can't think any better than that. He ought to resign from his office in the Federal Reserve. And the reason I say that is, I'm looking at a chart here right now.
You're going to have to hold that thought, Gus, because we've got to go to a break. But we'll be right back in just a moment with Gus Delzer, former executive with General Motors, with tremendous responsibility. But now he's trying to warn the American people about a disastrous financial course. Well, our guest this evening is Mr. Gus Stelzer, and right now, while many of our stations are not tuned into us, we're just going to continue this conversation. You were saying that you have a chart there going into the background of the implications of this massive trade deficit?
My chart, it's rather crude, but it covers a 58-year span, and it begins in the first year after World War II when we went back into production again. And it covers 29 years from 1946 through 1974. During that time, cumulatively in 29 years, we enjoyed an $87 billion trade surplus. And what started out in 1946 as a budget deficit, I mean, not a budget deficit, but a national debt of just $271 billion, it rose only $226 billion to $486 billion by the end of 1974. So those 29 years were fairly good. But it was in the latter part of those 21 years in 1971, which President Nixon had to abandon the Bretton Woods Monetary Accord, which turned our currency values over to central banks and currency speculators. So then we take the next 29 years from 1975 to the year of 2003, as I have it on my chart. In 1975, we had a trade deficit of $809 billion. By 1982, it was up to $36 billion.
It would be a trade deficit not of $800 billion. It was trade deficit
of $8.9
billion. $8.9 billion, right.
$8.9 billion in 75.
Right. Okay.
It went to 36.5 in 82. By 87, it went up to $159 billion. By 1995, it was $174 billion. By 1998, it hit $247 billion. 99, it was $346 billion. In 2000, it was $452 billion. In 2002, it was $482 billion, and last year it was $525 billion. Now, as I look at this chart, and I put alongside of that the budget deficits, every year, as this chart, the trade deficits increased, so did our budget deficits. They run in virtual tandem. And as a result, without going through all the numbers by year on budget deficits, we went from a $541 billion national debt in 1975 to where it is now $7.2 trillion. So when Alan Greenspan says the trade deficit will cure itself by market forces, that I can't imagine anybody making such an irresponsible statement. It has never happened.
Well,
he ought to know why. The problem with Mr. Greenspan is that he's a numbers cruncher. And he doesn't understand the relationship of numbers to people and how this affects people. When you have a $525 billion trade deficit, you're talking about the forfeiture of 20 million jobs in this country, and you're forfeiting all the tax revenue that might be generated with that kind of employment in this country.
In other words, if we were not running this deficit, if we were producing the goods here rather than buying from overseas, you're thinking there'd be 20 million additional jobs?
That's right. One of the things that really irritates me is...
Hold just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Gus Stelzer, former executive with General Motors, and he was saying that with the massive deficits we're running, if we were producing the goods here in the United States instead of, importing these products from overseas, there would be an additional 20 million jobs here in the United States. But you see, that isn't the agenda of the elitists who are running this. They want, of course, to redistribute our wealth. They're doing a great job. The one thing is they're not letting the American people know that there is an agenda, there is a plan there. If you haven't read it, it's called The Earth Charter. You need to get it. As Gorbachev said, that great paragon of virtue, Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev, this is the new Ten Commandments for the world. And it talks about redistributing the wealth between nations. That's what we're doing, redistributing our jobs, our wealth to the rest of the world, and gradually impoverishing our people. So pick up the story there.
Well, this is a situation that just cannot continue on. Greenspan is right in setting up an alarm signal about our soaring budget deficits and the national debt, which at the rate we're going, we're going to have a national debt of about something over $8 trillion next year. And if we think there's a decline in respect for the value of the dollar now, it's going to get worse as we flood the world with more of our trade deficit dollars, which have the effect of causing budget deficits. And then the real ironic thing about this, currently, the last figures I've had, is that foreign countries have slapped about $1.5 trillion worth of mortgages on our federal treasury, and they euphemistically call it T-bills or treasury securities. And some people are saying, isn't it wonderful that the foreign people are so nice that they're helping us finance our debt?
In other words, what you're saying is about $1.6 trillion of America's national debt is now held by foreign interests and foreign governments. Oh.
And some of the people in our own government in Washington and the people on Wall Street and the so-called economic and financial experts are saying this is good. It's a nice friendly gesture on the part of the foreign countries to do this. But what they're not telling us is that we gave them the money in the first place. These are our trade deficit dollars that are coming back. And when we send our dollars to foreign countries, they have to make some decisions as to what they're going to do with those dollars. Prior to 1971, when the Bretton Woods Accord was in place, and when foreigners felt that they had too many dollars, they could cash them in at our treasury at a rate of $35, and they'd get an ounce of our gold. But because we were on the verge of forfeiting all of our gold reserves, that was when Nixon departed from the international gold standard. So now the foreigners have all of these dollars and a question of what to do with them. So what they're doing with them, among other things I've just mentioned, they've put over $1.5 trillion of mortgages on our treasury, and at current rates of somewhere around 5% that we're paying them $75 billion a year in interest to get our own money back. This would be like a homeowner who doesn't have a mortgage on his house, and he decides, well, I don't need all the money I got here. I'm going to give the bank maybe a couple of $100,000, and as a result, pretty soon the homeowner finds that he hasn't got enough money to maintain his house. So he goes to his friendly banker, and the banker says, yeah, we'll lend you back some of the money you gave us, $200,000, but we want a 6 or 8% interest on it. That's how dumb our trade policies and our financial policies are. These are our dollars to begin with, and we lost all of the values that would come from production. Adam Smith made some very definite statements that all wealth is created by production, that is, the labor of people. Frederick Bastiat in 1850 wrote a little book called The Law, and he said the same thing, that everything begins with labor. And when we forfeit labor in this country, we are forfeiting income, we're forfeiting wealth, and we're forfeiting tax revenue. And that's why we have these horrendous budget deficits in the national debt.
One of the points you make, which I think is so very important, is that for every a person who's employed in production here in the United States, why, of course, you'll get a compounding effect from that, and there'll be three or four other people in support industries.
Absolutely.
So one manufacturing job may actually produce, what, two or three other jobs?
Oh, I would say in general manufacturing, it'll run somewhere between 4 to 7 total jobs.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Mr. Gus Stelzer. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Gus Delzer, former executive with General Motors, and we're talking about what's happening as far as our trade deficit is concerned. And Mr. Delzer believes that our current trade policies of NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization are really suicidal policies, because what's happening is we're sending our wealth overseas, that people are coming back, they're buying our bonds with this, then we have to pay them interest on the money they've loaned us to buy the bonds, and it was our money to begin with. So why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, in addition to foreign people having our trade deficit dollars to use to put mortgages and buy T-bills that our federal government then has to pay taxes on, and we Americans have to do that. If you were to do some little bit of mathematics and figure that we're sending foreigners about $75 billion a year as the interest on the mortgages that they have on the federal treasury, and then divide that by about 100 million households in this country, you're looking at the average household is having to pay about $750 to foreigners in order to get our own money back. But it goes beyond just the degree to which the foreign trade deficit dollars are coming back. They're also buying up our factories, our real estate, and so on. And one of the most egregious comments was made by President Bush a few weeks ago when he was in Ohio, and he was trying to defend himself on the loss of about 250,000 jobs in Ohio since he became president. And he talked about the Honda plant at Marysville, Ohio, that they employed some 6,000 people or some such number, and that this was a good thing. But what President Bush didn't say is that Honda acquired that plant with our dollars. They own that plant, and all of the I'd say 50% of the parts that go into the assembly of a Honda coming out of Marysville, Ohio, are made in Japan. And that further worsens our trade deficit. In addition to that, they are not paying the normal scale that was paid to American automobile workers. This was confirmed to me just 2 days ago when I was on your program on another network. I received a call from someone in Michigan, asked me if I knew about the latest union contract with General Motors.
Hold that thought. We'll just be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Gus Delzer, who is a former executive with General Motors. And we're talking about the fact that one of the Honda plants, in fact, I think we're talking more about the General, is this a General Motors contract that you're speaking of, or is this the Honda contract?
You called me about the General Motors contract.
All right. Why don't you explain this new contract, which is aimed at exactly what I've been talking about for some time, and that is there is a plan afoot to gradually lower the living standards of the American worker by gradually lowering his wages. I mean, how can we possibly compete with China, where their people will work there for $100 a month, when our workers are getting, maybe $150 to $175 a day of working here, $20 an hour, something like that. So what is what is actually happening with this new General Motors contract, which I believe bodes very, very poor for the future living standards of the people of this country?
Well, to begin with, the contracts with the big three American car makers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, of course, were developed over a period of many years going back to 1935 when the National Labor Relations Act was formed. And throughout all of those years, the federal government, through the National Labor Relations Board and other factions of our government, sided with the labor organization to put continual pressure on employers, especially in the auto industry, to raise wages and improve the working standards. But to bring it up to currently, General Motors has a lot of people that have been with them a long, long time. They're now perhaps in their 50s. They're hoping for some retirement. And their base pay, on average, is $25 an hour, in addition to which they get some fringe benefits that probably add another $5 or $6 to the labor cost.
That would be health costs. That would be pension, retirement, things like
that's
that.
That's right.
Right, disability,
right.
Right.
But now the new plan is that all new workers, their base scale is not going to be $25 like other people working in the plant. It's going to be $15 an hour. And they will get less in the way of medical coverage, limited retirement plan, if any, severance allowances will be reduced. Now, the point of this that I believe anyone can understand, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand this, that somebody making now $15 an hour is not going to be paying taxes to support our government like somebody making $25 an hour. And therein lies another facet of this problem of our rising national debt and our rising federal budget deficits. And this isn't just one incident that I've described here of a recent GM contract. It's going on all over the country, not only in revisions of pay scales, but also in the decision of corporations to shut down their factories in this country and move offshore. I had an occasion in early 1982. I was then retired from GM and had been for 6 years. I retired from them in 1976. I was able to learn about a very devious tax kickback scheme that Japan was running, whereby they kicked back as much as 30% of the taxes that they had imposed on their Japanese manufacturers, including automobile companies like Honda and Toyota. And if they exported it to this country, they would get the 30% back so that they could sell their cars far cheaper in this country than in their own country. And conversely, if an American company wanted to export its cars over to Japan, they would have to pay between 22 and 30% inbound customs tax, thereby raising the tax even higher, raising the price even higher than it was in the United States.
And so Japan has never been honest or straightforward as far as their tariffs are concerned. They've always put the barriers to keep out our products. They've always done everything they could to encourage exporting to us because they're interested in maintaining the stability of their society, and the people in Washington, D.C. are interested in undermining the fabric of ours.
The point of the little story, let me try to get to the point. I uncovered this thing. I developed the 59 pages of documentary on how this thing functions, and I sent it in to then Secretary of Commerce Malcolm Baldrige, the United States Trade Representative William E. Brock. I received confirmations from them that this is exactly what is happening, but they were not going to do anything about it. So I sent it in to a fellow, a man that I had worked with very closely before retiring. His name was Jim McDonald. He was the head of the Chevrolet division at that time when I retired. And when I called him in 1982 and sent him a copy of this documentation, he was then the president of General Motors. And he was shocked to learn what was going on. Over a period of about 6 months, there were efforts made through GM management, vice presidents, and Jim McDonald himself to get Washington to change this plan and to call Japan's hand on it. And I had correspondence from them and telephone calls and thought that things were going fine. And one day I got a letter, three lines long, from Jim McDonald saying that they had to abandon any further pursuit of this project. About 3 or 4 days after that, I got a telephone call from him, in which he asked me if I got the letter, and I said, yes, I did. I don't understand it. What's going on? And he said, we had been told from the very top level of the United States government, and this is 1982, so it could be none other than Ronald Reagan, that the Washington is setting policies, foreign policies, in the Pacific and the far Pacific, not General Motors. And General Motors is advised to bug off and get out of this thing. And so I said to Jim McDonald, what's going to be done? You're already in a position where you're losing money in the corporation because of the Japanese invasion. This is going to be the death knell of General Motors and Ford and every other car maker and all of the other companies that provide supplies to GM and so on, and the ripple effect, it'll be disastrous. And Jim McDonald says, I don't know really what can be done, and these are about his exact words. He says, I can't sleep at nights about this thing. But he says, if our own government will not support us, we're law-abiding people, and if they're going to undermine us with products coming in that evade our laws, then we will have no other recourse other than to shut down every plant in this country and move it offshore so we can get cheap labor, too. And in that way, that's the only way we're going to survive.
Maybe that's what it was all about.
Stan, that was 1982. Since then, General Motors has shut down about 50 plants in this country. Many of them have moved to Mexico. GM is now the biggest employer in Mexico. And a lot of people are very critical of General Motors and other companies for moving offshore. But I think we have to understand that it was the crooked politicians in our government that caused this. They forced American industry to do this or they would go bankrupt.
Sure. Well, I think that this is true with many of our industries. And, I think some of the industries don't want to do what they're doing, but they have to do it
to
survive.
They have to survive.
Because it is the official policy of the American government to actively encourage our industries to move offshore. This is not accidental. This is not a foolish policy. This is what it's really all about. And I've been studying this now for not quite as long as you have, but at least for 15 years. And I've seen this pattern laid out where I remember many years ago, there was a gentleman who had a frozen food factory, a packing plant over here in Watsonville. He told me that he could move to Mexico. They would give him half the money to set up a plant down there. They would lend him the rest of the money at 3% interest to compete against himself. He said, I can't compete against that. They can buy their produce cheaper there. They can buy hire their people cheaper. There's no way we can compete with Mexico when our government is subsidizing the establishment of frozen food packing plants in Mexico. That's what it's really all about. But you see, we can't let the American people realize that some people in our government have a different agenda.
Well, this whole thing goes back. You and I have talked before on other programs of the declining morality of our country. And I think this is really the most serious problem we have in America, where our nation and the majority of people, and it isn't just the politicians or the corporations or the financial people, but everybody seems to have gravitated to the idea that if we can get by and save a dime here or there, it doesn't matter any. They have lost total respect for this country and its products. When I see people driving a Lexus Japanese-made car, 100% Japanese-made, and they have a flag flying off of it, I almost have to regurgitate. I have to ask this fella, whereas the flag is something supposed to reflect our allegiance to America, I have to ask him, to what country does he have his this owner of this Japanese car, to whom does he have his allegiance? I was in the debate in 1998 in St. Louis against a member of the Wall Street Journal staff by the name of James Bovard, who had written a book about the fair trade fraud. And it was a deluxe affair with the cocktails and dinner, dress-up affair. About 150 prominent people of St. Louis were there. And we had a regular schedule of debating back and forth over some, and we had a final arrangement whereby each of us would make a final statement. My statement was this. I said, Mr. Bovard, I have read your book, and in it you have shed crocodile tears about factories that have closed in Cambodia, in Thailand, in Vietnam because of our restrictive trade policies. But I don't recall reading anywhere in your book any tears or any concern about the millions of jobs that have been lost as a result of your globalism free trade policies. So I have a question for you. To what country do you owe your allegiance? That was the end of the debate. 150 people stood up and cheered and clapped, and Mr. Bovard left through a back door. That was the end of the debate.
All right, well,
I got a letter the other day from Phyllis Schlafly, I think you've heard of her.
Well, I know Phyllis very well. She's a person of
faith. Head of the Eagle Forum. She was one of the first. She rushed up to me and threw her arms around my shoulders, and she whispered, whispered in my ear, she said, "You slaughtered him."
Yes, I love Phyllis. She's a very special lady.
And this is five years later. I got a note from her that says, I well remember the debate where you slaughtered Mr. Bovard.
Well, let's tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book. It's The Nightmare of Camelot, and because this is a very important book. There's a new edition, I think, eight new pages in the front. But it's the classic book on what's wrong with these policies that we're following.
Well, so the book is now in soft cover, so it's a lot cheaper than the hardback that came out a few years ago. It's 375 pages plus an introductory by me to bring things up to date. And it could be obtained the price is $12 on the book, and then there's $2.95 for shipping and handling, or $14.95. It's about the cheapest book you can get on the market, and yet probably the most informative book on economics and the way we're going in this country financially. There's a couple of ways that can be obtained. I have an email address, and on a previous program, I think we got mixed up and I gave somebody the wrong email address. My email address is my name, Gus Stelzer, G-U-S-S-T-E-L-Z-E-R. And then there's the...
Now, that's Gus Stelzer at what...
Then there's the at.
But I mean, what are you at? Are you at AOL.com or what?
At AOL.
At AOL.com, okay.
And then at AOL.com. So it's Gus Stelzer at AOL.com.
Okay, fine.
That's my email address. Now, I have a toll-free telephone number. It's run through MCI, and I get an extension from their normal 800 lines. And here is the number that people can call. I've already had several calls from previous programs with you. It's 1-800 and then 484-9527-1078. Those last four numbers are the extension numbers.
All right. Then we'll read it once more. That's 800-484-9527. 1078. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Hi. Very interesting and talk to people who are knowledgeable and who've been up at the higher levels in our economy. And my question is, what's Gus's feeling about whether the housing market is going up or if it's going to crash? Because obviously the guys behind the scenes will direct it in whichever direction suits them at the time.
All right.
I'm sure I can hear you too well here.
Well, the basic question is, Jim wants to know what's going to happen as far as real estate prices. Are they going to go up or are they going to go down? Because he says he feels that this whole thing will be manipulated by the people working behind the scenes to their advantage. So do you think there's going to be a real estate bubble, or are the prices just going to continue going up forever?
Well, there are several things in the mill. For the last month or two, the stock market, look at that first, the Dow, has been vacillating, and if you draw the trend line, is down. It perked up as a result of the crash between 2000 and 2002, when $8 trillion was lost in the market, and it kind of bound back, and the Dow was up around 10,800, something like that, about 4, 5, 6 months ago. Now today, the Dow had another loss of 124 points, and it's down to 10,117. And the NASDAQ, which at one time was up around 5,200, and which fell all the way back down about 1,100, about a year ago, it had some rebound, and it was up around 2,200 a couple of months ago, and now it went down again another 20 points today, and it's down at 1918. So what the market is doing by telling us it may have a day in which there is improvement in the stock market, it is followed by another couple of days in which it's going down. So there's a lack of confidence in the way the stock market is going. And not that I believe that the stock market is a bellwether of everything, but then when we get back to the real estate thing, the declining value of our dollar as a result of flooding the world with our trade deficit dollars can't have any effect other than inflation. And the Federal Reserve, through Alan Greenspan, has already indicated that there will be some increases in interest rates. As the interest rates start to rise, we're going to have a reversal of the real estate bubble. How serious that will be, it's hard to say. But it could be a very, very serious one. And and that being the case, I don't believe we should be careless and reckless about the other policies that we have, and to allow a continuation of our trade policies as they are, which are undermining the value of our dollar. Another report today was that the price of OPEC oil now is over $40 a barrel. That's a new high, all-time high. And when people are complaining about the price of gasoline, they haven't seen anything yet. The price of gasoline, the rise in price, is not due to some shenanigans going on in the oil companies. The oil company profits are rather marginal. If you want to blame anybody, you got to blame the banking industry and the investment people. Their profit margins are about three times higher than they are in the oil industry, but they're going to have to get their recovery of the increasing prices on oil, and the oil is going to be dictated by foreign forces who see our dollar declining in value because of our trade deficit policies. We're flooding the world with our dollars. You know, there's a
as far as the price of the housing. Do you think that as the interest rates go up, the prices of the houses will eventually start to drop?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So you're suggesting that if this bubble starts to go, we could have some real problems.
Stan, I'm almost... you see, when I was 14 years old in October 1929...
You remember that.
I remember the crash. I remember all of the 10 years of the Great Depression. It was a terrible time. And we are headed in that same direction.
Well, I was born in February of 1929, so I don't remember too much of it. I do remember about 1933.
But I remember. Here's another thing that, because of I've lived through all of this. I lived through all of the 20s, and I was a good student in school. I graduated from the Missouri Business School in St. Louis, where I studied accounting, commercial law, and so on. I was 14 years old and got the diploma for that. And so I worked as the only steady wage earner in our family. My father was out of work most of the time because of the Depression. 25% of the working people in the country were without a job by 1934-1935. And that's a figure that is really astounding when you recognize that in those years, the mothers and the wives really didn't work. The husband and the man in the house was the breadwinner, and he was without a job. And so it was a tough time, but even during the great troubles of the Great Depression, we were a civil people. There was hardly a day that would go by that we didn't have someone knocking at our back door, not our front door, but on our back door, pleading for something to eat, just a half a sandwich or a slice of bread. That's how tough things were. Every day this happened.
Yeah, I remember, and I remember they used to mark little mark on the door if you gave them something, so the next person would know that these were people who would help you.
Yeah, but still you could walk the streets even at night, everywhere, with no fear of being mugged or being assaulted by anybody. We were a civil society. We're no longer a civil society. If we ever have another economic breakdown anywhere close to what happened in the 1930s, I hesitate to think what's going to happen to this country.
Well, Jim,
it isn't going to be pleasant.
I agree with everything you're saying, Gus. Jim, does that answer your question?
I think the immigration, they're all going to be fighting for a piece of whatever is left. We cannot take our economic policies too lightly. We're definitely on the wrong path, and the path we are on of free trade, we've got to abandon that.
I sure agree with you totally. Jim, did you have anything else you wanted to ask?
No, but it sure sounds like this is not the time to buy a house.
This is not the time to buy a house. In fact, if I could, I'd sell my house, but we have no place to move to, so we have to stay where we are.
Right. Thank
God
you.
Bless. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I guess we're out of time. I want to thank you so very, very much for being with us, and look forward to having you on our program again. That telephone number, if you'd like to get hold of Gus Delzer, 800-484-9527-1078. That's 800-484-9527-1078. Thanks so much for being with us.
Send me an email. And I check my email every day, and if you send me an email, anybody sends me an email, I'll get back to you.
That's Gus Delzer at AOL.com. God bless you. Thanks so much, Gus. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, I think that's it's always a good program, very, very intelligent. He's 89 years old. I hope when I'm 89, I think as clearly and concisely as he does. Under any circumstances of why, let me remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're dependent on those who out there listening to us. We're primarily listener-supported. That way we can tell you the truth. We buy time on radio stations all across America. 60 stations will hear at least some of the material that we're putting out. They're going to get the information they'll never get from other sources. If you'd like to be part of our team, part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, why, it's simply call that number, and we'll be glad to send you either the March or the April newsletter. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our internet programs 5 hours a day there, either on our site or on the other networks we're on. We do 4 hours of shortwave every day, and of course it's 5.745 megahertz, but that's all up in the internet. Your job is to tell other people about our programs, to encourage them to listen. We've got to, like Paul Revere, let people know that trouble is lying ahead. It's not that the redcoats are coming. They're already here. Our government has been taken over by people who have a different agenda. They have a different worldview. Their dedication is not to the preservation of our freedom under God, as laid out in our Declaration of Independence. Their dedication is to the idea of a new world order and a new world religion, and America's wealth and financial power is being used to force all nations into this new system of government that has been the plan of the secret societies since the beginning of time. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to understand that Nimrod wanted a world government, Alexander wanted a world government, Napoleon, Adolf Hitler, but nobody has come closer than Cecil John Rhodes, who shortly before he died in 1902 said, "It'll take 100 years before my dream comes to completion." If you want to read his dream, we have his Confession of Faith. We'll be glad to send it to you, where he talks about the idea gleaming and dancing in front of my eyes. Is this, why shouldn't we form a secret society to unite all the underdeveloped nations of the world under British control and reunite with the United States? If you'd like a free copy, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.